yes, then you go and you ride your section once. But before you ride it again and again, multiple times, I get off the bike and I actually have a look at everything that my tire track was doing, kind of like an Indian tracker in the, and you read your lines, because on the ground tells you everything. If some rider goes through it and I didn't see him, I can go in there and have a look. Okay, he had the power on for this amount of time. He, even though there's the dirt splattered out, he had that amount of power. He let the clutch go there.
Hello and welcome to episode 105 of the Trials Australia podcast. I'm your host, David Grice. If this is your first time here, welcome. The Trials Australia podcast is a global initiative and we regularly speak to current and former champion riders, local club riders, administrators, event organisers from all around the world. Anyone really who has a current or former involvement in the sport of trials. We've had a lot of questions lately about how you can support the podcast, and now there are a couple of ways. As you know, we are taking the podcast international. In April, we are going to El Trial de España, which is the premier trials event in Southern California and a massive fundraiser for the USA's TDN team. I'll be live streaming from that event in April this year, and my host over there and partner in crime on this initiative, Gabby Caperon, has set up a GoFundMe page to help bridge the costs to get across. As mentioned in last week's episode, we've also started a Patreon page, which offers you an opportunity to make a contribution on an ongoing basis. I'd like to extend a massive shout out to Sandy, our newest Patreon subscriber. We really do appreciate all your help. So in summary, option one, you can make a single donation to help with the El Trial de España trip via the GoFundMe page or on an ongoing capacity via Patreon. Links will be in the show notes. And if you're not in a position to financially support the podcast, that's okay too. You can help us by sharing this podcast with your friends. You can subscribe through your favorite podcasting app and all episodes will be automatically delivered to your device. And also remember, you don't need to wait for the podcast episodes to come out to connect with us. Pop over to our Facebook group, search Facebook for Trials Australia Podcast Community and come join the discussion. And there is also a YouTube channel, Trials Australia Podcast, for any YouTube content we put up. This episode is sponsored by GasGas. GasGas are excited to announce that they have a special rebate running on their 2022 bikes. The 2022 TXT Racing bikes are available in a 125, 250 and 300cc capacity. GasGas have continued to refine these bikes and the new models are no exception. In Australia, all of the 2022 models come with a $1,500 factory rebate. And stay tuned for later in the podcast to hear about our even deeper discounts on the 2021 models. We are a global podcast, so please inquire through your local dealers. However, in Australia, the GasGas Trials dealers are the Hell Team, Revolution Trials, PTR Trials, Moto Dynamics, and Rock Hopping SA. This episode is also sponsored by the Hell Team. The Hell Team supply and service Ohlins and Ryga rear shocks for trials bikes. In 2011, the first Ryga rear dampers were available on the Ryga replica GasGas models, and since then, they've gone on to produce some of the best shocks available for all different trials brands. They are now standard fitment on the premium models of GasGas, TRS, Sherco, Scorpa, and Vertigo. In conjunction with GasGas and Adam Ryga, Ryga developed a six-way adjustable damper for the expert trials rider. So apart from having the spring preload and rebound, the high and low speed compression adjusters, it also has a hydrostop, a variable adjustment to stop the shock bottoming out on big impacts, and then a variable bottom rebound adjustment, which is a must-have for the expert rider. This holds the damper in its compressed state to make driving vertically up objects far easier and controlled after a big splat. The Hell Team are Ryga specialists. They work very closely with the factory in the Netherlands to service, repair, and supply Ryga trials dampers. The Hell Team can service and use the best Italian Adriani machinery to do so, as well as being able to offer an exceptionally fast turnaround on jobs. Give the Hell Team a call if you're not sure about anything and they can help guide you on what's the best settings and spring rates for your shocks based on your weight and ability. Get in touch with the Hell Team at www.thehellteam.com. In this week, we've done something new with the episode. We've taken a key topic that I let our guest choose And in this case, Bruce has chosen to go on and discuss a bit of detail around the topic of quality practice makes perfect. This is a new feature that I want to try and introduce into the podcast to keep it a bit fresh. And the idea is that not only do you get to hear the stories of the writers, but also you have some more specific takeaway actions that you can try and implement into your writing. Bruce is a very experienced writer and also a coach doing some time over in the USA in the Trials Training Center. So when this man says quality practice makes perfect, we should be listening. In this conversation, Bruce takes us through his early days of riding in South Africa and how it went from BMX bikes with his brother to a passion of moto trials. We hear about the failed attempts to get overseas in the UK, which got cut short through to foot and mouth, and then how he went over to the USA and ended up becoming second in the championship in the 2005 NATC. He even had Ryan Young as his minder. He got to ride the world round in Duluth, but how his unexpected hip injury started to bring it all undone. Bruce went back to South Africa and continued to grow the trial show's business back home for emigrating to Australia in 2020. It was a real treat. I'd also encourage anyone to go back and listen to the conversation with Brent Larish, episode 58 as well. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Bruce Larish. Bruce Larish, welcome to the Trials Australia podcast.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. You're the second Larish I've had on the podcast. I interviewed your brother, Brent, well, a few episodes, about a year ago now, I think.
It feels like I'm back in South Africa. He always gets first place. So I'll settle for second interview.
Well, it was weird. I wanted to just get a sense of, you know, South African trials. Mm. And I know there's trials bikes. I know there's South Africans. What's going on with trials in South Africa? And I just randomly reached out to the first person I could find on the internet and said, hey, can you direct me? And he's like, actually, I'm 15 times champion, so Maybe I can help.
Well, you got the correct person. Brent's a very charismatic and a people person. You got the right guy there.
It was a wonderful story, and I'm also keen to hear your side of it, because you've now gone one step further. You've emigrated to Australia, and I'd love to hear also your thoughts on what it's been like doing trials in Australia and all the traveling around the world you've done and things like that. But beyond that, I'd like to do something new with the podcast. And this is new for our listeners as well. And you can be our guinea pig on this. But I'd like I'd like to introduce a key topic that is of your choosing to go into a bit of depth and discussion and really leave some lasting and tangible takeaways for our listeners to, you know, think about and to work on. So beyond just the stories of how you got to where you've gotten to and what you've experienced along the way, I really like to focus on this key topic. And you've spoken to me prior to this and said that your key topic would be quality practice makes perfect. Is that correct?
Sure. I think most riders will pick something that changed their career.
Yep.
Just changing it from practice makes perfect to throwing that out and throwing in quality of practice makes perfect, which I learned a lot when I had a bit of more international experience than just trying to find my own feet type of thing. So to me, that's a very good topic to talk about.
And this is not just any old person saying this. You've actually had some time coaching and spent some time coaching over in the USA for a little while. So you're actually somewhat of an authority on that topic as well.
I would like to think so. Really, I know I haven't had the main world round international experiences others, but one guy in the US told me you can be the best rider, but not necessarily the best coach. So it takes a different type of person to actually find details in your riding and to discuss it in a way that the person can understand it. So I'd like to think I had a lot of experience in coaching. So we'll see how it goes.
Absolutely. we'll loop back to that topic a bit later on in the podcast, but let's start where it all began. So take me through Bruce's early experience with trials bikes, and where did it all begin back in South Africa?
For those of you listening to Brent's, it's going to be pretty much the same. Brent and I just used to ride our bicycles in the backyard and get drums and crates, and we didn't know that trials bicycles existed, so we just did it on BMXs. And at that point, our dad could see that we were very focused and wanted to ride. Now, he rode back in 81 and 82, and that was when Brent and myself were born. So he kept an old Yamaha and an old Kawasaki in their in his garage. And when we were just big enough physically to put our feet in the ground, to ride those, we started and we tested the waters out and to see how enthusiastic we would be. And let alone 3 times a week practicing in the beginning was enough for him to see that this was the direction we were going to take.
Yeah, absolutely. And so were these trials bikes specifically?
Yes. So it was that KT250 and a Yamaha TY175.
Okay. So your dad is obviously, was as we discussed with Brent, who's already in the sport and sort of got exposed to it. And then you guys saw that and followed suit.
Yes. So he rode it for a year or two. Sorry to elaborate on that. For a year or two when we were born, then stopped in about 1983. And then started up again with us. And that's one of the best parts, I think, in Brent and myself. Pretty much life is just the bonding experience that trials brings with the family. So my dad and myself, you can ride one section, discuss, and you spend just a lot of time together. So it was just a fantastic sport in my life for myself.
Yeah. And was there any yearning to go and do other things, or were motorbikes priority number one and attraction number one?
If I look back, I could remember going to friends' birthday parties and they would all be inside playing the new PlayStation that they got, but I'd be outside on my BMX bouncing up the stairs and down. So I don't see any other way that I would have gone than to ride something with wheels. And trials is also, to me, just mentally stimulating. So it's a great avenue for me.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. It's easy to look back in with hindsight and put a positive spin on it. But as you say, if you're just one of these kids, it's just always outdoors, always on two wheels. Yeah,
for sure.
There is just a sort of natural pathway. So when did competition start getting serious for you and go from just being practicing to, you know what, I think I want to have a go at comps and starting to get serious about it?
You know, I don't think there was ever a discussion saying, let's go for competitions and see how well we could do. Like I say, there was the three of us just starting out. 6 months in, we decided, okay, the new season's starting, so we'll go and have a look at the first competition. And we tried it out and just kind of hit it off from there. But even that first year, we were just riding for the fun of it. So it wasn't more or less trying to see if we could win. It was just the enjoyment of it. The competition side grew, and then we just got better and better, and then just became more and more competitive. So the fun has always been there. And then the competition side just made it funner for us. So it amalgamated together.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I get that. And I suppose you and your brother are there egging each other on. So that's got to be a sort of positive circular loop to progression and to competitiveness and to driving you forward.
Oh, it's been fantastic. I think if I look back, him and I have always been best mates. We did everything together growing up. For the riding side has just been fantastic. It's taken us overseas together and we get along really well. So it's just been a positive spin on everything.
Yeah, that's awesome. So take me through the various levels in your progression. So I think as we were discussing before this interview, you've gone up class after class, but you made a decision that you stayed in each class to win a championship before moving up.
For sure. I think that my dad made it clear to us that he wants us to win a championship as we go along in each class. It kind of, you can see it today that a lot of kids will move up before they're actually used to winning and they can ride the big stuff, but they're not really used to amalgamating everything together and putting the small stuff together and dealing with the pressure of the whole event, even if it's easy to win. Fortunately for us, we went through the classes relatively easily. We didn't stay in a class for longer than a year when we entered the class. So it happened easy, but if we didn't, we would have stayed back and made sure we learned how to win first before we moved up.
Yeah, I think that's a fair call. I'm watching some of the sort of younger riders I get exposure to, and you see them, yes, they can do the big stuff, but to really go back to what you've said just then, it's bringing it together with the small stuff as well. It only takes a 5 in 1.5 and a stall to separate you against these more seasoned, experienced riders. You may be only going to do the same dabs, but you make the silly errors, and in tennis it was like an unforced error. You do a few things like that, and that can be the difference.
It's
just keeping that mental, so you don't get mentally fatigued, but also, yeah, your attention on it. It's
for sure.
Yeah, it can be a big difference.
For sure. And in trials, it's all about your mental state, really. So if you're mentally strong, you're going to just do a lot better. And I've learned that over the years.
So, was there a moment when that came into sharper focus?
I've always been a fiery kid. So and that's why I chose the topic, quality practice makes perfect, because that took me the longest part of my career to actually learn that. And I I obviously compare myself to Brent a lot because, like he also mentioned, we rode the same stuff growing up, the same championships, and he just excelled in at a certain point compared to where I did. And that was more of a mental ability that he had than what I had. So when it started to click for me, I could feel that that is what really changed for me. And I matured more as a rider than just gung-ho kind of.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's a good reflection. You got all the way to a pro class in 1997. You obviously, as you say, were progressing pretty quickly. When was the point where you realized maybe traveling beyond the shores of South Africa is where we need to go? Was it around that sort of point?
The first year in pro class for me was 97. Again, I was fortunate because it took me a little while to click. And to put into perspective for the youngsters, not to lose faith, I remember my first pro event. We do 5 laps of 10 sections, so it's a long day.
And That's a big day.
Big day. And I lost 167 points on my first trial in a national. And it's tough, but you just got to keep at the grindstone at that. But fortunately for me, I progressed really fast. And the guy that was moving overseas to the US, who paved the way a little bit for our idea to get there, he was the next hot thing to win the championship. Okay. And my first year before the end of the year, I beat him twice, tied with him once. So it gave us ambitions to, okay, we're up there. We need to figure out, okay. And then 98 came around and we could plan a little bit better as we got more professional.
Yeah. So I've just gone up a grade, and yeah, I share those sentiments of not to be too disheartened, because it would be easy to look at your scores and go, that reflects something closer to a T20 cricket score than it does a trials score. But it's just, I've taken the decision to, you know what, I'm just going to chill for 12 months.
Oh, for
and
sure.
Not really care about it and take the pressure off myself of feeling like I'm trying to achieve a certain goal, and just focus on the improvement and focus on the gradual reduction in scores rather than necessarily set myself a target like I need to be able to do a certain thing.
Sure. And it's progression, and progression takes time, especially when you've been doing something for a while. So it's good to have a different outlook. Otherwise, you just get demoralized.
So did you achieve that result of reaching the championship in the pro class eventually?
Yes. So first year was 1997, learnt a hell of a lot, destroyed a bike, went to 98, progressed a lot, got second in the championship, managed to win more rounds than the guy who won, but was a little bit more inconsistent, which seems to be my South African career. 99, I managed to lock it down, so that was great. And then I had to run down before Brent started the steamroller effect on his championship role.
Well, congratulations, that is awesome. So I know that, as you mentioned, Brent took over the reins of championship, but I want to know, how did you cope with that brotherly rivalry? Was it easy? Because, you know, you're happy for your brother's success, or were you sitting there going, grr, come on, I can do better?
I'm going to go grit my teeth and say I loved his success. No, it was great stuff. And again, if he didn't, I wouldn't have been the rider I am today. So again, in hindsight, it was great for me in the long run for international experience, but it was tough for me because growing up, I was always fairly taller than him, and both of the and that being bigger than him has contributed to, I feel, our kind of styles being slightly different, even though we rode the same stuff, because I was able to muscle the bike a bit more, whereas he had to use momentum like he discussed in his and use body language more than what I had to. So he would be able to handle things as they came, whereas if I couldn't break it up and do it exceptionally clean and smooth and flamboyant, then break my rhythm up mentally, and then I would crumble, sort of thing. I think that, and him being slightly smaller made him fight for harder longer when he would ride against me, which was slightly better as we grew up. To see him come past and set a new level, which I knew I could easily ride at his level, I would either blow him out the water with an excellent day, or I'd fade away on. And he had the stronger mentality for the big events, which was obviously the counter. You don't win it if you don't do well at the championship and only do well at the club events, then it's not really, it's pointless.
Yeah, so, no, I definitely hear you. That's an excellent point. Now, you guys then decide to start traveling abroad, first the UK. So it was a bit of a failed or a false start because of the foot and mouth disease, but you'd actually made a decision to travel to the UK and head over there, and it all went pear-shaped pretty quickly.
It did. Our mother's British, so we've got British passports, so it made it easy for us just to go in there, get jobs, learn, and obviously they were there, quality of riders and learning slippery stuff, because South Africa in the area that we ride is just big, dry, grippy stuff. So we needed to learn a new technique kind of thing. So the slippery stuff thought we would also do and make us better riders. So we headed off there, and that did turn out to be unfortunate for us. So that we headed back like a week or two before our first national, and we rode, I think, three times in the space of 3 months.
Bugger. Mm. That is a real unfortunate outcome.
Yep.
It is otherwise a great destination. But you decide to then pivot a year or two later and head over to the USA. You mentioned there that there was someone that sort of paved the way to getting you, or making think that the USA was an option. Just explain why you thought we'll go to the USA instead, and then take us through your journey to the USA.
It was getting to that point in our career where our age is getting up there into what we decide whether we're going to carry on or. So like Brent said, we made one last hurrah, and there was one individual that went out to the US and rode in 1998, did relatively well, but also didn't really podium at all. So it was up in the air to see also where we would come. So they ride the B-line in TDN, so it's not like an A-line country that you're just going to be fighting through every single section type of scenario. And that was our decision to go there. Yes, the country is absolutely massive. But like Brent said, we were extremely fortunate enough to associate ourselves with the Trials Training Center, and they looked after us. Just I can't even appreciate them as much as what I should, because they were just fantastic to us. And again, that 650 acres of mountainous areas, training resorts, they took us around to all the nationals. It was just one of the best riding highlights of my life.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Did you know it was going to be like a multi-year at that point, or did it just unfold that you stuck around?
It unfolded. So we got there. It was tough for us because we also have the South African rand, which is the currency just is very hard to equate to it because there's such a difference. So that's also why the Trials Training Center helps us out so much, just with the travel expenses and all that. It made it a lot easier for us, but we worked hard. So it also showed that we want to stay around, and they helped us out. And then a job opportunity opened as the trainer there. So the other guy was leaving at that point in time, and they could only afford one of us. Now, Brent had a slightly better year, and I still had big ambitions. I wanted to prove myself a bit more. So I put my hand up and said, I'm willing to stay. Now, we also tight-knit family, so Brent decided to come back and start up something so that we could fall back into South African life when we're done. So that's how the next couple of years rolled on for me, and I had a year's experience under my belt at that point, so it progressed from there.
Now, 2005, you actually ended up having a great year. Take us through that year, and tell us who your minder was.
Before I even get to it, that was the golden era for me. It was 2005. So 2004 was very tough. I must admit, I learned a lot. Didn't have a set minder now that we get into the minder topic. So that changed around a lot, which made it for Brent and myself very tough competing against the other riders, which have been riding with their minders consistently for a couple of years, and there's 10 to 12 rounds. So
this is the US Nationals as well. We should just clarify for the listeners' benefit that haven't heard Brent's interview. You guys went over and you made an attack on the entire US Nationals season. It was your first year in 2004, but it was enough to give you, and it just was a springboard for your 2005 attack on the series.
For sure. So at the end of that year, I became pretty much the coach for the upper end level riders, which again, that's where the quality practice makes perfect kind of thing sank into my brain. So I had a year's experience of what I needed to practice, where I should more or less be, changed my whole riding style, whole riding practice around. I didn't have Brent there. So one of the topics I want to discuss about in that how to practice type of scenario is going to add that in. So it made it's the first year that I've actually been riding without Brent. I had to practice all by myself. Luckily, I managed to secure Ryan Young, 6 times AMA US champion, as my minder. And he is a very eccentric, passionate rider that you expects a lot and you want to please because he's a fantastic guy. So that
helped. I've had Ryan on the podcast and it was a treat.
Yep, I listened to that one.
Ryan was fantastic to talk to. He was, but I don't even think that podcast did justice to just how good a communicator he is. Because obviously he can talk fine, but it's the explanation. I've gone back and watched Ryan Young training videos on YouTube, and I'm still learning stuff today. Like, he's such a good communicator at the way he gets things across. So to have that man in your back corner as your minder, wow.
He's so enthusiastic and expressionative. So even while you're riding through the section, he's screaming at you and the tone of his voice changes as he's going through. And I remember one time I fived one section and then the next time he's just screaming at me, "It doesn't matter if you dab, just get up yet. You just need to get up." And obviously at the top of his voice, so it's you just holding that throttle wide open. It doesn't matter if you're launching that thing into space, you're getting up just so that he's happy with you. It was fantastic having him as my minder. Never mind the whole Sherpa team, and that's what I said with Brad Balmer, that the whole Sherpa team was great.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many people that I've spoken to from the States that look, anything they've had to do with Ryan and Brad and RYP, it's just all been a positive experience.
For sure.
So to hear you say and echo that again, it's really no surprise. It's the quality unit. But for your attempt on the 2005 series, what was your goal? What was your target? How did you finish 2004? And did you have any ambitions in 2005 that you maybe didn't admit to, but you had secretly in your back pocket?
I remember they did Shan Moore does a newspaper over there, Trials newspaper, and he did an
interview. On the Pegs, I think it's called now.
And he did an interview on me. And I remember the one question he asked me, where do you see yourself in the championship? I said, and I told him I had a difficult year. I never podiumed once in 2004. The best result I had there was a fourth. My hunger was there. And then we had an Irish guy in there that's coming in to ride a couple of rounds. And obviously, Jeff Aaron was just brutal.
Dominating. Yeah.
But at the same time, I told him that in the interview that I'm not going to cut myself, you know, short here. I'm looking for results this year. So I'm hungry. And I didn't know where I was because we didn't ride. I rode with the guy that got second in the championship for one weekend, but him and I never really gelled personality-wise. So he was there for a week and he rode off in one spot and I rode off in one spot. And then, so it was difficult to gauge myself. And then the first round of the championship came and got a second place just behind Jeff Aaron. And I was blown away. And then another guy that was at the training center at the time that was the main coach the year before I took over. And I remember sitting there and telling him when I saw what trophy Jeff got. And he got the Longhorns, the Bull Longhorns trophy. And I'm like, oh, I want one of those. And the next day, I just rode out of my skin and won my first event there. And I've got the trophy still hanging up. It was amazing. And the first time I'd beaten Jeff. So it was...
Oh, my God. So it's all starting to come together. You must be having good confidence now, having that under your belt.
For sure. And it was a tricky event because the scores wasn't too high, which I suppose also when every time the scores were high, Jeff annihilated everyone. But it was a tricky one because there was big steps, but if you just made one mistake, you were out of it. So you had to full concentration throughout. It was also the first time that I'd really been working with Ryan for the whole weekend. He did come down to the training center a month before just to work with me for a day. And then when you go ride around in the US, you get there on the Wednesday, you have good quality practice throughout. I started to click on the second day and it was memories.
My God. And so how did that season play out? Because there was a world round at Duluth.
Yes.
As well, on top of the NATC series. So just take me through the rest of 2005 and how it ended.
There's so many rounds there and you're on the road for so long that I think like the Duluth event, I think we had the California event, then the Ultrail event that you mentioned that you're going to ride, which was the next couple of days. Then there was another event. Then there was the Duluth event. So I think at that point in time, by the time I got back to the Trials Training Center, I was on the road for just over a month and a half, just circulating the whole country. But it was, for me at that point, I was hungry and I was starting to do well. So things started to click. And also for me, what was really made it nice for me was because Ryan was in the picture and shouting at me and things started to click. And Ryan's philosophy is you always finish last at an event. You always watch everybody. You ride last. So at that point in time, every competition, we were ending the competition last. So the people that had finished would actually ride around and would have a spectator group coming around, like 10 to 20 riders. It just wanted a watch. So that was, it made also that you made me feel special, which was really nice. Until I got to Duluth, where I thought, okay, the year before I did the observer role just to see what it was like. And then I thought, okay, I'm gonna ride this year. It's my only opportunity to be from Africa. I'm never going to ride a full championship year. I'm going to attempt this once-in-a-lifetime kind of scenario that I've always wanted to do. Oh, it rained and rained. If you watch that video, I remember Fujigas's bike got washed down the river at the end of the event. But I had the best year of my life, and I was in over my head. Those riders are just absolutely phenomenal. Again, they probably put in more in 1 month than what I've put in a couple of years, but they're really good.
And you managed to take second overall in the NATC championship that year, but it was tight coming into the last round as well, I believe.
Oh, yep. It was funny enough, my style changed to being really good at big, dry, grippy stuff and training at the TTC to being really good at the slippery technical stuff. And I think that's also because I changed my practicing over to what I thought what I lacked. I had one or two bad rounds in Colorado, which kind of put me on the back foot. And then Chris Florin at that point was him and I were fighting out for second place. And he managed to win the penultimate day, which really made it difficult. So I had to win the very last event to secure second place. And
not just beat Chris Florin, but you had to beat Jeff Aaron as well.
Had to beat Jeff Aaron as well. It did happen once or twice throughout the year, never mind the first place that I won, because Chris won one or two. But when he won, I managed to beat Jeff, and he just managed to have a better day. Yep, that last day was a pressure cooker. And there was still a video floating around of that last one where I rode that last section, and it's the memories I have of just that pressure coming into that very last section on the very last day, having to do it. And again, South Africa, you don't have your scoreboard that you go and give your card in. So when you go back and have a look and see where you are, it can also play a mental a game on you. So it just adds to that pressure because you know how you're doing.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. We briefly interrupt this conversation to remind you that this episode is sponsored by GasGas. GasGas are offering exceptional value on the 2022 bikes with $1,500 factory rebates while stocks last. They're available in 125, 250, and 300cc capacities. Again, that's $1,500 factory rebates while stocks last on all remaining 2022 stock. And if that wasn't enough, for any 2021 bikes, there is now a $2,500. Yes, you heard that correct. $2,500 factory rebate on any remaining 21 bikes, making them absolutely fantastic value. Please contact your local GasGas dealer. Now, back to our conversation. Now, congratulations. You achieved second in the end by winning that final round. And that's awesome. You've gone from South Africa, you've gone into the USA, and you've really cemented staying in the USA. What was your decision like at the end of 2005? Did you immediately want to stay on? And were you happy? Like, at this point, did you start thinking, is it time to come back home? What was your thought process at that point?
When I took over as pretty much the head coach there in 2005, and Brent and I discussed it, it was going to be a two-year deal for me because I'm also family-orientated. Like I say, Brent's my best mate, my dad riding with me every single time. So he's also like my best mate, and I've got a relatively large family. So it was tough being away from them for so long. And I gather that 2005 year, my passion was really kicking in and it was starting to click. So it made it worthwhile. I did unfortunately have an incident on a ladder that determined the rest of my US career, I must admit.
Is this the one hip wonder incident?
Yes, it led up to a hip replacement on that. So as the years went on, I lost mobility in the left hip. And then my final year was just extremely tough for me. And that was the decider really that in 2007. Oh,
no. So it was just innocuous, but it was a fall from a height off a ladder, was it?
Yes. So I turned around and the ladder slipped out from underneath me. I landed on a brick that was at the bottom there. And it's called avascular necrosis, where the impact stops the blood supply to the joint. And in the beginning, it doesn't actually hurt, besides obviously the initial impact. But when I say the beginning, the first year or two, because your joint has still got the nutrition's there ready from built up from the years. But then after the impact, it starts getting no nutrition to it. So it starts breaking down. So,
oh my God.
So it starts getting more and more painful. And obviously,
you must be like the youngest person I've ever met that's had a hip replacement then.
When I walked in and the x-ray, the doctor saw my things. He says he's never done a hip replacement on a younger guy. I had to wait for as long as possible. So it just got worse and worse and worse because you got to get it a few times in of your lifespan.
Oh, because a hip replacement isn't good enough yet to last you the rest of your life. No. So if you have one, you've got to actually plan to have another one at some point.
For sure. 10 to 15 years, depends how you look after it.
Yeah, okay. Oh, God. And of course, if you're riding motorbikes, then, you know.
It's relatively smooth. Mountain biking is very good. But obviously, if you don't get up a step and you jump back, it's the impact that kind of hurts it.
Yeah. And did that have any immediate impact then on your USA time or did it start to show up later on?
That actually happened December 2004 when I flew back for a month. So the next year, I didn't actually know anything was wrong. 2006, I fell off a trials bicycle, put a hairline fracture in it, and then that's when I went for an X-ray, and that's when they told me I have this problem. So over the next couple of years, it's steadily got worse.
Okay. So how was 2006 for you in the USA? Because that must have been a sort of, you've got a trajectory started going up. How were you feeling walking into 2006 and what were your sort of hopes and ambitions?
2006, I think I was obviously hopeful. The year before was a great confidence booster to me. They also were looking for a Montesa ride at that point. So I negotiated with Brent to come out and ride for them. So I knew Brent was going to be back. He took two stints there. I think the first one was 6 months and the next one was just 2 weeks. So it was great to ride with him again and be around. But again, at the local events, he did really well because I think obviously our styles are different and I tend to really concentrate when it gets big and tough and hard. So it was when he came out and we rode a local event with an eye opener. But again, he rides really well at that type of scenario. I wasn't too worried. But one of the highlights of our career, like he mentioned, was he podiumed and I got a first place. So that was at one event, which was great because it was both of us on there. And coming from Africa, we know the difference now between the levels that you actually need to get to.
So I must imagine, you know, did you still have any yearning to get across to Europe? And because I hear that South Africa did have a TDN team down the track in 2008, but was the thought of Europe still luring you across after this success in the USA?
It wasn't because we were, I think I was 27 or 28 when I got out of the US and I'd ridden a world round and set a world round and then rode I think it was the blue line in the AMA and I just knew I was, it was, you had to be riding it with those guys. I think James Dabble said it in his interview that if you're not riding with him every day, you fall off the pace. I've never ridden with him. So Duluth hit me in the face really hard. It was an awesome event and I'm glad I experienced it, but it was way out of my league. So I knew I would never be able to ride world rounds or whatever. And then getting back to the TDN team, yes, it would have been fantastic. But the only time that South Africa decides to send a TDN team around was the year I got back and Brent and I decided to start up a new business, which was trial shows. And we just managed to secure a contract to ride at Sun City throughout the spring break season there. And if we missed it, we would have lost out on that for the next couple of years. And we had just done our big international experience in that and needed to start putting down some feet and getting the money rolling in type of thing. So we declined.
Yeah, I understand.
And then they never sent another TDN team.
And so you come back to South Africa, your time in the USA is behind you. You must have still a lot of fond memories though. And did you ever manage to pop back or was that it? Have you not been back since?
No, haven't been back since. It's far for us. And again, it's expensive for us. So it's not just a pop in and ride kind of scenario. We started business and got married and kids and
adulting.
Yep, pretty much. And it's just carried on with life kind of thing. Which happens after being a professional sportsman.
Yeah, we'll say professional sportsman. I'll say professional sportsman.
I'll take it.
So 2008, you're coming back to South Africa and you obviously have a bit of experience now riding from the USA. You achieve another 3 South African championships and 2 indoor championships. So South Africa has indoors as well, does it?
They do. Again, Brent and I got, because of the show life that we did, we got sponsored by Monster Energy and they treated us really well. And at one of the big shows that we also had our show rig out there, they had outdoor area and they said, look, we've got budget. If you guys want to put an event here, we can get the crowds already here because it's at, I think it was a big outdoor show. So it was thousands and thousands of people just walking in and out as they come. So with their budget, we managed to get big skip bins and tires and put on for two years in a row, we put on a indoor event.
Beautiful. That's awesome. So when did you, because you came across in 2018 to visit us here in Australia, you rode the Australian Nationals. Was that, how much planning went into that trip? And was the view always to, because I know you've obviously ultimately ended up emigrating here. So that's great.
Yeah.
But yeah, was trials the starter?
No, it wasn't. I think coming back from the US, especially living there, it was tough to move back to South Africa because everything gets, I don't want to go into too much detail, but it's easier living in the first world country compared to all the crime and stuff that goes on in South Africa. So the plan was always to try and emigrate, especially when you've got kids that you need to bring up. Never mind that I'm middle aged now, I've still got a long way to go myself. So it's nicer to live in a first world country from experience. So I'd already put in the application to emigrate to Australia. And then again, the people at Monster Energy were just absolutely fantastic towards Brent and myself. They gave us budget and we were allowed to use that for plane tickets and accommodation. And we decided, why not come over and see what Australia is actually like? Because we'd never actually been here. So that was our reasoning for the visit.
Yeah.
And then we could also at least have some international experience. And kind of feel young again.
How did you go? Do you remember looking up the scores? But I haven't checked them recently. You guys did pretty well, if I recall.
Yep, we got, I think, a fourth and a sixth, if I can. It's a little blurry to me now. But again, you guys have TDN teams and all that. And Brent and I have been focusing on shows and trial and family life. Not to put us, make excuses for ourselves, but the biggest thing for us was the time limit, because we don't have time limits in any of our sections. And then we don't work with minders. So it's all trying to relearn that again. And the pressure was great to feel that again. But obviously, you guys have got really good riders.
Yeah, we do. I think we're just obviously, relative to our European counterparts, it's obviously, it feels a bit like the USA in that regard, in that, when compared to some of the European riders, how we stack up, and you draw it into sharp contrast. But the growth and the caliber and the trajectory of trials in Australia is looking pretty positive at the moment.
It's fantastic. I only see positivity here. So,
yeah, exactly. And what's been your experience joining clubs and stuff in your new home of Queensland? What's it been like in the welcome here?
It's frustrating because I'm trying to settle into life and there's three clubs and they've got all events on. And so it's a bit tough. And in the beginning, it was coronavirus. We managed to sneak in just before coronavirus really hit. And then I couldn't get any of my bikes out or get a bike here. So I had to loan bikes in the beginning, which thank you to those people that loaned me bikes in the beginning. Revolution Trials was one of them. Arthur Herman. So I've got to give a big shout out to them. Otherwise, it would have been 2 years without riding. But it's the trials here. And the trials community is different. They're all nice. They're all happy. They all talk to each other. It's not like anyone's, you ride this or I'm sponsored by this. I'm not talking to you. It's just a different kind of society to me.
Yeah. Listen, I hope to cross paths face to face at some point later this year we start traveling around for some of, now that the borders are open again and I can travel interstate.
Yep.
You've done some Roof of Africas as well. You were the only rider to finish it on a trials bike.
Yes.
But it doesn't sound like it was a pleasurable experience.
For Brent, it wasn't. I've done it on both. I've done it two times on a trials bike and then the other four times on an enduro bike. It's tricky because we're not really professional sportsmen anymore. So if you're not riding 3-4 times a week, that enduro bike just fatigues you like you cannot believe. And you're not used to putting in those 10 to 12 hour days anymore. So you've got to train really hard for that. And Brent and I are from a couple of decades of riding on a trials bike. We kind of trials bike fit. So a trials bike is light and nimble, lots of torque. We put a seat on, extra fuel tank. It was slightly heavier, obviously, than what it would be normally, but you're not really muscling around 115 kilos. You're muscling around 90-something kilos. It was just a lot easier to ride. Not that we were going for the win on the trials bike, but again, there was a couple of flaws, like the braking system. It was not up to par with the heavier payload, and you're on the brakes a lot harder and longer than what you would be on a trials bike. So it had its difficulties. But I think if you plotted along, most people would finish it on a trials bike.
Yeah, okay. Oh, cool. there's a challenge for everyone listening.
Yeah. Do your homework.
And during this time, you were the importer for Montesa, Yodagas, and even TRS as well over the years.
Yep. So Montesa was our first one. Then when I got back from the US, the main brand is Beta. Now, I've got a left hip replacement. I can't ride Beta because it's hard for me to kick the left-hand kickstart.
Yeah, okay.
So I've got to ride a different brand. And unfortunately, there was no other type of brand there. So I became the Yodagas importer, had its problems. Took 2 years to get a bike in and that. But so that didn't happen very long. And then Jordi Terra started the TRS team. And then so I was excited about that. 2017, I think I became the importer, brought in a bike, but then I put in the application to emigrate. So that was short-lived. But
yeah. Okay. I'd like to circle back to that topic we were dabbling with at the start around quality.
Sure.
Practice makes perfect. Because I think we've now got a reasonable degree of an appreciation of your time in the sports. And we also have a understanding of your involvement in coaching. And so working with great coaches as well, like Ryan Young. I'd really like to hear your thoughts on this topic of quality practice makes perfect. And just what can you tell us as the Trials Australia podcast community that we can take away and implement in our week-to-week riding?
Sure. So like I said in the beginning, I think each rider that you're going to interview now is probably going to pick a topic that kind of changed their riding style a little bit, because that's the thing that kind of stood out and changed what they, you know, made them progress more. I was always that type of kid that, you know, and riding with my dad, he's got more energy. He's like a Jack Russell here or a border collie. He just ran. So he would ride. And as soon as one person would finish the section, we'd ride. So we had always had the energy and the ambition to ride and ride. We could outride anyone, but it's not about the quantity that you actually ride the section at, which that's where I find I struggle to switch my brain over. And I thought if I just rode more, I would learn more, but it's not actually that, because if you're not actually teaching yourself how to practice and what you're doing wrong and how to actually ride a certain obstacle, and most people, when they practice that, they think they're doing it, but you can see they kind of just enter the section, ride the section in a practice section, and then they just ride back in it without actually analyzing what they did. And it's all, if you watch any professional team like Formula One, MotoGP, they'll do a couple of laps, come in, read the data, have a look at what they're doing, change this, change it, and they'll try different stuff to actually see what works, instead of just riding the same and approaching everything at the same pace. Or
all right. So if I could just take that apart a little bit.
Sure.
And make it as practical for our listeners as possible. You've set yourself a practice section.
Yes.
And you've gone and ridden it. Maybe you've taken a dab. So you've tried it again and then you've cleaned it. But what you haven't done is you haven't stopped. You haven't walked it again. You haven't looked at other lines. Maybe you've only ridden it the one way. And so your advice would be go back, try it. Maybe try different lines, maybe try hopping, maybe try a floater turn, maybe try taking it wider in certain areas to narrow it up in other areas, and just try it in a few different ways rather than just being myopic and singular focus at just going gate to gate.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. But obviously, it's not that simple. You've got to break it down into different layers type of thing. If you really want to get your mental state, it's like you would make a section. Walk the section, make sure it's clear. Most people ride with still branches hanging over. So it's now you're taking the time to actually clean it out and you're getting mentally prepared for what you're going to be riding instead of just free riding. Chuck some flags in, make sure you've got boundary markers. And this is what helped me out a lot is, like I told you 20 minutes ago when I didn't have Brent riding with me, I had to change my thinking up a lot. So I would make a section and before I would ride it, I would figure out, okay, I think I'm going to make a dab there and there. And so I would give myself a goal. Okay, I'm going to get 3 dabs throughout the whole section. And just another point is I counted every point, not just up to 3, because that way I continued fighting from point A to point B. So as soon as you lose 3 points, you lose focus and you just...
That's it.
Yes. So if you lose
3 or 30, it doesn't matter. No, yeah,
that's exactly that.
Actually, it does matter.
It does.
Yeah.
If you lose 1 point already, you start losing your mental state. I remember some practice sections I had, it would be 20 points I'd be losing because I'd get my fitness up in really long ones and I would be fighting for every point that I could. But getting back to the proper practice, so I would guess my points, let's say 7 points throughout the section. But now I know who I'm riding against. Jeff, Chris, Cody Ware, Pat Smargie. Then I'd even throw Brent in there because I know how mentally unbalanced my brain is to ride against him because he always beats me. It's just someone I'm trying to get my head wrapped around that I'm going to beat him. And then that way also, when I get to an event and let's say Jeff Aaron pulls off just an absolute blinder off of one step, I'm like, I can ride with him. In my practice sections, I beat him. Even though he's not there, you're still mentally strong at that practice section or that section when you're actually there with the person. It's not intimidating. It's not, you've got confidence and fight all the way through type of scenario.
So quality practice means for you mental preparation. It means not just setting out a section thoroughly, but also clearing the section so your mind's in the right state. It's having the ability to count beyond three, so you're actually getting a true reflection of how close you were to cleaning a section rather than just stopping it at the three. And it's also about having that ability to think through what it'd be like having competitors with you to sharpen your competition day focus.
It is and more, really.
Yeah.
So that was just the mental capacity that I try to change. And then let's say, for instance, now trials is a very analytical sport. So yes, then you go and you ride your section once. But before you ride it again and again, multiple times, I get off the bike and I actually have a look at everything that my tire track was doing, kind of like an Indian tracker and you read your lines, because on the ground tells you everything. If some rider goes through it and I didn't see him, I can go in there and have a look. Okay, he had the power on for this amount of time. He, even though there's the dirt splattered out, he had that amount of power. He let the clutch go there. He got that much height on the rock. He had the power on the rock when he impacted the rock, or he didn't, judging by the tire track going up the rock, which way the tire slid on the rock along, how much power he put down until he slid, the type of thing. So you can read a whole lot just on the very first attempt that you do, because it's new ground. So it's just taking that time to analyze what happened in that section. And that's why you actually watch a rider to ride the section before you actually go in, so you can actually see what's going on.
Is this advice, do you think, as practical to your everyday clubman rider, is it, or do you need to be at the upper echelon of the sport already to be noticing these benefits? We all know the cliche, practice makes perfect, and what we're saying here is no, it's not. It's quality practice that makes perfect. But some of those things like you were talking about, where noticing the finer details of how a person went through a section, if you're still struggling with slow turns and you're a clubman rider in new in the sport, well, some of that might be lost on you, is all I'm saying. Is there a point at time where it becomes more relevant, or is there a way to reframe this that it does actually have relevance for everyone?
Okay, yep, that's perfect. Great, because now I'm going in the heat of the moment, going flat out into proper you will be world championship style type of training. So yep, getting back to the quality, practice makes perfect. It for the guy that wants to get better and all that, it's like in South Africa, everybody tells me I tinker too much, but that's because I'm used to, my bike needs to be 100%. Before I ride, I check my tire pressures. I take the gauge out with me. And this is what every rider should be doing, whether you're in the clubman level, whether you're in the pro level. Because just the smaller increments, if they change, you actually, your style changes. So throughout the day, the temperature goes up, your tire pressure changes. So you might do well at the first lap, and the second lap, if you haven't checked your tire pressure, you're going to be a different rider. So everybody should be checking their tire pressures beforehand and be diligent about it. And it's the same thing on setting up your bike type of scenario. So it's like even looking at the section, okay, you've got it that you've made a mistake in the beginning or even before you ride. I'm hitting a couple of points here, sorry. You've got to analyze where you went wrong. So if I made a mistake on one section and I'm hitting my second lap, I'll make sure I get off my bike to have a look at that exactly. What's happening to it? Are riders actually hitting it in a different area? Am I taking the wrong line? Instead of just going back at it, no, I'll get it this time. Be hard-headed about it. So that's where
And that applies to everyone.
That applies to
everyone. So just to recap, take the time and be particular about the setup of your bike, no matter where you are.
Sure.
Whether you're just starting or you're more advanced, because it does have a flow-on effect to how you ride and your style. And then the next thing is, even if you're a newer rider, still get off, still analyze where things went wrong. Don't just be bloody minded about keep repeating it.
Yes.
Just take the time to analyze and reflect as well. No matter whether it was because of where you dabbed or how you dabbed, just take that time to go and assess it.
For sure. Even if you have figured out why you dabbed while you're going around the loop, go back and still make sure that is exactly why you dabbed and see if there's a better route.
Now, what about... So we've got a former guest, Neil Price, who's an award-winning coach actually in Western Australia, and he's doing an online coaching program. And one of the things he advises is to break up your quality training into three parts. So your training is some fun. Your training is some focused competitive style, and your focus is also on things you need to improve. So don't just be always spending your time just focusing on the things you're good at. Make sure you have some fun as well so you enjoy it, but also spend some time in a competitive environment. Get some cones out, pretend it's a section and things like that. When you were spending all this time with your brother, just I guess through osmosis, you would probably be having as much fun as you would be competitively training. But how did you go in that year when you didn't have your brother and you're also trying to have to coach people? How did you break up the training to ensure there was, you know, quality, but also enjoyment and focused on the weaknesses?
So you're talking about 2005 when Brent wasn't there. That was the difficult part, really, because I had more kind of resentment that I never podiumed. So that whole year was analytical. It was breaking it down. It was more intense than anything else because I had to prove to myself that I was good enough to podium type of scenario. And the previous years was all fun and improvement and competitiveness. So that 2005 year for me was more just intense, raise my level. I need to do this. I remember I would come back and log down my hours on that day on my calendar. I would add up all the hours. Then I'd compare it to the very next year and I would see where I was. So the US, I took more as I need to improve. I need to make this intense. I need to get it right.
Yeah. But even the discipline of logging practice hours, I guess that's something that we could all take away. If we go back to this topic of quality practice makes perfect, does it need to be all time on the bike? Is there other things that you can do, maybe static balance in a garage for a few minutes a night, maybe some core strength workouts to offset your or augment your riding time? Was there other stuff as well that you'd frame it in quality practice?
It would be, I think, more you would be determining, okay, you're trying to get up a step. And for instance, if you're not really getting too much height, then you could, on the days that you can't go out and ride and practice your technique, you would be, which you would do anyway, is do your
jumping.
Jumping up on your boxes and stuff like that. Getting the leg, the correct muscles moving, your stretches, your stuff like that. Spending time on the bicycle to make sure that you could practice a lengthy period than just get out for half an hour and be stuffed kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Oh, good. This has been something I think we can all take away. And I think there's definitely some real value that our listeners can extract from that. So thank you very much. But I can't let you escape our standard questions. So here's a couple of quickfire questions for you. What's one thing you wish you would have known before you started riding trials?
If one thing that I knew before I started trials is I would probably say that I'm too passionate and I want to do it all the time, so it can cause a rift in the relationship. It was my calling, if I can say that, and I had to learn to back down because it was just the thing I loved.
So moderation is the one thing you wish you would have known.
Maybe not at my peak, but you still think you're 20 again or 17 and that's the way life should be. When you start getting older, you need to start diverting your direction a little bit. It's still...
Understood. What's been your biggest challenge and what did you learn from it?
My biggest challenge is Brent. I learned probably the most off of that guy because he's the mental state. So I learned to be mentally strong. And that's why I said if he didn't beat me in, 2000, I probably wouldn't be the rider that I am because I had to... It was tough mentally. And it wasn't just a quick tough, it was lengthy periods. So I had to learn to be diligent and learn different techniques.
What advice would you give someone who was thinking of starting trials?
Oh, it's the best thing ever, especially if you've got a family and you've got an open face helmet, you chat, you can make mates all over the place. Everybody in the sport is great characters. They're all nice. It's a family orientated sport.
What would be some resources that have really helped you the most along the way? They could be people, they could be organizations, it could be anything really.
Probably everybody that just helped me to get to where I am, especially my dad, my brother. Like I said, the family aspect of it is what kind of got me to really just be to love the sport, really, because you can spend so much time with family. It kind of just grows you as a person because you're not just out on your own. It's a single sport, it's you're riding individually, but it just seems to be you interact with so many people.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. Yes, absolutely. And what about a myth? Is there a myth about trials that you think we need to debunk?
Myth. I won't say the myth is that the top guys' bikes of all are souped up and all. I would say the biggest myth for me that I found was that the guys are actually very good. It's the ability on the person. It's not really the motorcycle.
Yeah.
So you can see that even if they swap bikes, they're still extremely good, which I think if someone says that their bikes are works bikes and they've got all this, if they jump on an old twin shock bike, they'll annihilate you on it. So it's, there's no real quality of bike that, yes, it makes it better, but it's more the quality of the rider.
Yep. Yep. Well, I think that might be one of the best ones I've had yet. Thank you. Bruce, it's been an absolute treat. Thank you so much for being on the Trials Australia podcast. I'm really glad we got to chat. Genuinely, you know, interested to hear of all these people that have traveled the world and this sport's taken them around. So thank you for coming on and sharing your story. And I really do hope to catch up face to face next time we're at a competition in Queensland.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And thank you for having me on here. I think what I really like about this is you get to learn the character of the individuals instead of just what the media says about it. So about them. So it's a great podcast. Thank you.
No worries. Cheers, Bruce.
Have a good one.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Trials Australia podcast. This episode was brought to you by Vertigo. Experience and passion define the basis of the Vertigo brand. Vertigo grew from an idea creating a bike to match the passion that existed within the team. Despite being the youngest of the Trials brands, they have now had years of consistent year-on-year growth and have proven themselves at the dizzying heights of Trial GP, at the harsh conditions of the Scottish Six-Day, and there is also a strong groundswell of representation around the globe amongst your everyday club riders. Vertigo set themselves apart by having the most technically advanced bike as well as the most customizable. Vertigo have made a significant announcement with the launch of their new Nitro models. Every few years, Vertigo do these updates, and the Nitro is a significant update for 2022. There is a new frame, new silencer design, new fuel tank, water pump, bash plate, rear brake system, and a redistribution of the electrical components. They'll be available around late November and early December, and prices will be $11,350 Australian dollars for the 200, 250, and 300cc capacities. Please visit vertigoracing.com.au for all the details of the new model. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. Links and show notes can be found at trials.com.au. There you'll find how to connect with us on all the various platforms. If you want to get in touch, you can also send us an email via podcast@trials.com.au. And if you like this show, please subscribe and leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts.